Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, July 17th, 2019. Your humble host is recovering from a moonlit hike, crawling up Mount Tamalpais here in Marin County last night. It was an arduous climb, but we managed to hit the summit just as the sun was setting and the moon was rising, and it was a fabulous experience. My legs are a little sore, and I'm a little sleep-deprived, and it's my way of confessing that I watched zero cable news or other television news last night. So I didn't get to see the machinations on the floor of the House of Representatives as Democrats brought to a vote a resolution rebuking Trump for his divisive, angry, and racist tweets aimed at the so-called squad. And Trump, of course, continues to maintain he doesn't have a racist bone in his body and that there was no racism involved and, you know, they should go back to where they came from or leave the United States if they're not happy. So he continues to maintain that his motives are clean. And it's only these women who utter vile, hateful comments and lies, according to him, that require his attention to them on his Twitter feed. So this is an exercise that doesn't really accomplish very much. The resolution, which invoked Ronald Reagan twice, perhaps in an effort to attract Republican votes, only got four GOP votes and Justin Amash, who left the Republican Party on July 4th in an announcement at the Washington Post. He now considers himself an independent. So the vote was 240 to 187, and it is, of course, just ignored by the Republican majority in the Senate, and the White House uses it to once again try to paint the Democrats as way out of touch. Now, there were a series of altercations. There are many conservative Democrats who were very uncomfortable, not only at this resolution, but the impeachment resolution that we'll get to in a moment. In addition, the Republicans threw up a smokescreen saying that Speaker Pelosi used language that was prohibited. It violated the rules of decorum of the House of Representatives. Now, Pelosi denied it, saying that she had cleared her language in advance, but later in the evening, her number two, Steny Hoyer, announced that, in fact, she had violated the House standards. Pelosi was adamant. She said, "I stand by my statement. I'm proud of the attention being called to it because what the president said was completely inappropriate." And at one point, the Democrat who was presiding over the House chamber, Emanuel Cleaver, a Democrat of Missouri, he stormed off the dais. "We aren't ever going to pass up, it seems, an opportunity to escalate, and that's what this is. We want to just fight." So it clearly was a little ugly, bit of a skirmish, and the Democrats are trying to act like they are united in support of the squad. But there are many Democrats, particularly those who are part of the freshman class, who came in from the purple or red zones, unlike the squad. They quietly want Trump to prevail here. They'd like him to squelch the individuals who have been so forthright. Then you bring in the Republican layer. They're interested in replacing Nancy Pelosi as the icon that Republicans can rail against and run against with the squad. And Trump believes that he is victorious in this episode so far. The House resolution he takes is a kind of badge of courage, a certificate of achievement in trying to brand the Democrats as extreme left while pandering to right-wingers who enjoy the racist theater that he has created. So then comes Al Green, not the Reverend Al Green who had all those hit singles, but Al Green, the Democratic African-American congressman from Texas. He filed articles of impeachment last night with a very short fuse. He called it a privileged resolution, which requires the House to act within 2 days. The articles of impeachment accuse Trump of committing high crimes and misdemeanors with racist comments aimed at the four congresswomen. So this presents a new conundrum for Nancy Pelosi. She's adamantly opposed to impeachment because she thinks that it will hurt the Democrats' chances of retaining control of the House in 2020. She believes that it's a futile effort because the votes are not there in the Senate to remove. And she's correct about those votes. With a few exceptions, the Republicans are holding firm, afraid of a Twitter firing squad or being primaried by somebody even more conservative and amoral than they are. And so Pelosi has two choices. She can move to table Al Green's resolution, and she probably has the votes for that. Or she could refer it to the House Judiciary Committee. Now, tabling it will likely draw the votes of most Republicans. Referring to the committee is more dicey because Republicans won't likely support that, but there are members of the Judiciary Committee who are chafing at the restraints that Pelosi has imposed. I'm sorry to quote House Majority Whip James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina. He said the House isn't ready to debate whether to impeach Trump. We may not ever be, he said, but we aren't yet. And as I pointed out on Monday, while I understand the political calculations that Democrats make, they're fundamentally wrong to avoid impeachment. It only enables, encourages, and provides impunity for Trump. To go even deeper, to divide us along racial lines, to mischaracterize Democrats, to conduct these ad hominem attacks. And I believe that the Democrats are making historic blunders here. Jonathan Friedland has an op-ed in today's Guardian, and he recounts some of these same issues, and he reaches his conclusion that Trump is a racist and that impeachment is the most likely remedy. He said, it's race-baiting, no doubt about it, but it might also be effective, as Trump's 2016 campaign proved. This is a dilemma for Democrats. Do they try to win back those white, low-income voters who supported Trump last time? Or do they use the president's hateful behavior, including his attacks on the squad, to drive up turnout among those appalled by it, especially black voters and young people? And Freeland continues. He says Trump can only be removed from office by a 2/3 vote of the Senate, which will require Republicans to turn on him, and only 4 of them did so in the House resolution. The grim truth is that no matter how racist his behavior, no matter how much he abuses his power, Republicans belong to Trump now. He owns them. And Friedland concludes, the result is that Democrats face a choice between doing what is right morally and what is politically smart. When you're dealing with an amoral bigot in the White House, those two things are not always the same. Now, he ducks a recommendation, and I shall not. I believe that this is an historic moment, and the Democrats have to damn the torpedoes, they have to damn the consequences, and they have to finally stand up and fight this monster. But they will not, and we are stuck with the consequences. And look at this. The Washington Post is so desperate to find a Republican who is turning on Trump that on the homepage today, I found this story. A former top Texas judge says she's left the Republican Party over Trump. Elsa Alcala joins a small group of conservatives alienated by Trump's remarks. She's a retired judge. Hardly a consequential political figure in any way, shape, or form. And yet that's how desperate we are to find a Republican who is so offended by this episode that they will turn on Trump. And I still believe that if the Democrats pursue impeachment, if they can force the clear choice that a Republican senator like Lindsey Graham would have to make. That it's his ass or Trump's. That's what it's got to come down to. You have to threaten them with losing their jobs. And the Democrats don't go for the throat. They don't play to kill. And I'm sorry to say that I'm really frustrated and deeply saddened by the condition of political rhetoric in our country today and the folly of the Democratic strategies. At the Washington Post, Fred Barbash points out that Trump's latest racist remarks can and will be used against him in court. Now, this is more of an accumulation rather than these specific remarks. But he points out that in the litigation over the immigration bans and various other initiatives of Trump, including the latest effort to change the asylum regulations, that the language that Trump has used in these public comments will be used, and that judges have been factoring them in. In the case of the court that was handling the issues related to inserting the citizenship question into the census, George Hazel of the U.S. District Court for Maryland ended up taking another look at the developments after we learned about that Republican strategist who died, who was central to the census question as a way of further suppressing the vote of non-Republicans. Well, it led the judge to further review statements by Trump and his campaign and tweets demonstrating what is called discriminatory animus. So within hours of the announcement that the new asylum regulations had taken effect, immigrant support groups have filed suit in San Francisco and other jurisdictions, challenging, quote, "It's a longstanding federal law that merely transiting through a third country is not a basis to categorically deny asylum to refugees who arrive at our shores. By excluding anyone who passes through another country," they said, "the new rule cruelly closes our doors to refugees fleeing persecution." And the lawsuit here in San Francisco seeks an injunction that would put a hold on the policy. The lawsuit said the federal law explicitly allows migrants to apply for U.S. asylum regardless of where they enter the United States unless they were firmly resettled in another country after fleeing their homeland. And as we reported yesterday, the effort to use Guatemala as a staging ground for asylum seekers from the so-called Northern Triangle of Central America, that has fallen apart. It didn't make any sense to begin with. And BuzzFeed won't name the individual, but quotes at length an asylum officer who works for the Department of Homeland Security, who has called the change in the law, or the regulations, because the law hasn't changed, illegal and immoral. Quote, "I was horrified," she said. The officer added she received no official word on the change until an email with guidance was sent Monday night from the head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Asylum Division. Quote, "I saw it right as I was coming to work. We're all aghast." And if she does have this kind of conscience, I would certainly welcome this kind of rebellion in the ranks of the border officials. Now, she said the policy is facially illegal. I mean, I don't personally plan to enforce it. If it's not enjoined, I will ask for other duties, I guess. I need this job, but my oath of office won't allow me to make adjudications contrary to the law. And so we're at that stage where principled individuals occasionally surface. But most are like lemmings, and they are knuckling under to the demagogue in the White House. They are responding to intimidation and fear, and they channel that through in their professional capacities. This is an ugly and downward spiral, friends. And we are witnessing it right before our eyes on a daily basis. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Have I recently thanked Terry Paris from Berkeley? How about Brian Massey, Bill Janetta, and Ted Kelly? They each kick in $5 or $10 a month, and I'm imploring you to do the same. If you're not a current subscriber, let's fix that. Trot on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, then select Become a Subscriber. You hit the sign-up page where it's easy to choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book. I've got a few more copies of 2100, A Dystopian Utopia, the blueprints for human survival under climate change. And it's a $55 value, so a $50 annual subscription, you're $5 ahead. And I pay for the postage if you supply a mailing address here in the continental U.S. And should you be allergic to PayPal, you can correspond with my post office box, box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. I'm very distressed to report at internal fighting at Planned Parenthood at a critical time, when abortion rights are under siege, when states like Missouri and Alabama are clinging to a single abortion clinic for the entire state, and the pro-life wave is gaining even more momentum, and with Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, Roe versus Wade is quite vulnerable. So to see the kind of dissension that has surfaced at Planned Parenthood and the firing of the woman who was named its leader less than a year ago. She is Leanna Wen, and she is a very tightly wound woman. I've seen her interviewed on television, but I thought she was fairly effective in challenging the recent wave of anti-abortion laws and in trying to frame the debate related to women's health care and less about the politics of abortion rights. Well, we're learning that she caused huge turnover at Planned Parenthood. She brought in a cadre of her own people. She used to be the a health official in Baltimore, and that the old guard and the new guard didn't get along. And they hired a management consultant to try to smooth things over. But ultimately, the board decided recently to terminate Dr. Leanna Wen's term as the president of Planned Parenthood. So this comes at a time as we see the Democrats in confusion about abortion rights. As I've pointed out, the presidential candidates who are trying to garner Democratic primary votes are more outspoken in support of abortion rights. Those who are incumbents are choosing their words very carefully. And they look at the polling that says that this is roughly a 50-50 issue, and they figure that for every vote they pick up, they lose one or potentially do. And it's that kind of calculation, similar to the impeachment calculations, that I believe are a big drag on the effectiveness of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders is challenging his rivals for the Democratic presidential nomination to refuse campaign contributions from the healthcare and, health insurance and pharmaceutical industries. He is giving a speech today, No Health Insurance and Pharma Money Pledge, and that, of course, is mostly aimed at Joe Biden and, to some extent, Senator Kamala Harris, who have both been favored by contributions from those industries. No surprise, the script was written a long time ago, but El Chapo, whose legal name is Joaquin Guzman Loera, was sentenced today in the Brooklyn Federal Court to life in prison. He'll serve it at the Supermax in Colorado, if all the indications are accurate, and it does bring closure. Now, I want to note that I have no sympathy for a murderous drug trafficker like El Chapo. But he is a product of the failed war on some drugs that the U.S. continues to wage. And his conviction will not change the flow of drugs into this country. Just last week, the Coast Guard announced that they intercepted a submarine with tons of cocaine on it off the shores of Mexico or Southern California. And this submarine was not just a little mini sub. There were 54 crew members on it. That shows the scale of the efforts to bring drugs into the United States. And no laws, no walls, and no enforcement even of submarines by the Coast Guard will ultimately change that. As long as we are consuming those drugs, they will be delivered to customers here in the United States. Over at Consortium News on Monday, they announced that the website had been attacked in a malware assault. And I noted that the website was very slow to load, and then ultimately it did crash. They report at Consortium News that many articles going back to 2011 are not currently available on the site, and they are working to repair the damage. And in an article posted today at Consortium News, Elizabeth Voss, who is co-hosting the new CN Live video feed on Friday afternoons, and I may participate this week on Friday, she noted that the first episode of CN Live had been posted, that the Twitter account for Unity4J, which is the pro-Assange movement's Twitter account, had been arbitrarily shut down, and that on the same day, CNN released its new smear on Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Now, they're not trying to say that those are all connected, but they are questioning whether there is some pattern here and that the efforts to smear Assange and to diminish support for him may be part and parcel of this denial of service or hacking attempt. And I did post on Twitter when I heard the news, please don't call CrowdStrike. Remember when Eric Holder left the administration to go back to his million-dollar-a-year job at, I think he's at Covington and Burling? They even kept the corner office for him while he was attorney general. And he announced that he is leading an effort to promote fair redistricting at the state level after the 2020 census is completed. And Holder's group is the NDRC, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, and separately, but working for the same goal, Common Cause is using lawsuits to move forward on efforts to end gerrymandering and redistrict in a fair way. And now we learn that Emily's List, the pro-women's group, is joining this effort. They are investing $20 million in more than 500 state legislative races. Now, this is welcome news because after Obama won in 2008, the Democrats were just so giddy that they all went home and, played Pokemon or something. And instead of working to elect Democrats at the state level to prevent the kind of, ridiculous gerrymandering that occurred following the 2010 census, and that in turn led to the loss of positions in state legislatures and governor's offices that hammered the Democrats when the maps were drawn. Now, the real, solution here, since the Supreme Court really just was derelict in its duty, its refusal to see partisan gerrymandering when it is so obvious, well, it's up to us. And I am proud that in California, we have a Citizens Redistricting Commission that redrew the maps in a fair manner, and that is a model that can be used all across the country. I've got a couple of stories to share with you that I would file under well-intentioned but futile for the Democrats. They are set to vote today to hold Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt for failing to provide documents related to the Trump administration's efforts to add that pesky question on citizenship to the upcoming census. Now, I do believe that both Barr and Ross are contemptuous. But this will be dismissed as just another partisan effort to tarnish them, and it ultimately will have little or no effect. Similarly, Chuck Schumer, the opportunistic Democratic minority leader in the U.S. Senate, he's a New Yorker, he has now joined the group of people that is growing, supporting not reparations for African Americans, but a study of reparations. And this is the position that is supposed to cause African Americans to support Democrats in 2020. Now, I personally consider this a very thorny issue. And my own view is that reparations, in many cases, would be appropriate. But given the racist partisan divide in this country today, I'm afraid that trying to move toward reparations in the current climate is going to backfire. And it will simply strengthen the racist attitudes that many Trump followers have. And so I think that, unfortunately, the timing on this issue is not very good. And in the same stack here, we have a new proposed bill in the House of Representatives that would provide free legal representation for certain asylum seekers. This is the idea of Congressman Anthony Brown of Maryland, and he is offering up what is called the, I think it has a name, doesn't it? I can't find the name of the bill. At any rate, it would provide guaranteed legal counsel for asylum seekers under age 21 and seniors older than 60, those who identify as LGBTQ, pregnant and nursing individuals, and those with special religious considerations. I don't understand why people between age 22 and 59 are excluded. Oh, here's the name of it. The Equal Justice for Immigrants Act of 2019 would also allow asylum applicants to stay in the country, our country, throughout their court proceedings. And under the proposal, only U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services employees would screen applicants, reversing the recent Trump administration decision to train Customs and Border Protection agents to conduct the initial asylum interviews. Great idea, but it's dead on arrival in Mitch McConnell's Senate. And even if you could overcome that, would Trump ever sign a law restricting his intentions to bulldoze the asylum process and regulations? I doubt it. And finally today, we bid farewell to John Paul Stevens. He went on the Supreme Court, nominated by Gerald Ford back in the 1970s, and he served 34 years until 2010. He described himself as a conservative, but he supported abortion rights, racial equality, gay rights, the rights of the accused, the rights of illegal immigrants facing deportation. He shifted his position and regretted his support to reinstate the death penalty back in the 1970s. And he was a strong voice opposing the Citizens United decision, which legalized campaign bribery on a corporate level. And here's the fascinating quote. He told the New York Times in 2007, "I don't think of myself as a liberal at all. I think as part of my general politics, I'm pretty darn conservative." But during his 34 years, the majority on the court moved rightward, leaving him appearing to be more liberal than he felt he actually was. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the damn place. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.